As we leave Knob's flat, we are about to begin our gradual climb out of the Eglinton Valley, and we'll soon be leaving the Eglinton River behind. But I can promise you that the scenery is going to get even better as we go along. If you take a look at how high and steep the valley walls are becoming, the Earl Mountains on your left and the Livingston Range on the right, and then look at the river, you can see that it's unlikely that that little river carved this huge valley. As I mentioned before, a great glacier pushed its way through here in the last ice age, grinding and scraping a path through the solid rock of a much shallower valley on its way down from the mountains. One other thing the glacier did was push big chunks of rock into different places. A glacier can lift boulders the size of a house and carry them down to other areas. About 10,000 years ago, when the last round of glaciers retreated, they deposited great heaps of rock around their snouts. These deposits are called moraine. The small hills on the river flats to your left, here at Knob's Flat, are moraine deposits. The glaciers retreated back up the valley in stages, dumping moraine at each stage all along the flat here. The mountains you're driving through formed over the last 3 million years and are still rising as a result of a collision between two of the Earth's great crustal plates, known as the Australian Plate to the west of Fiordland and the Pacific Plate on which you're driving. The rocks around here were no pushover, I can tell you. We have many different types, from relatively weak volcanic and sedimentary rocks here in the Eglinton Valley to the very hard and resistant gabbro and diorite, which forms the dramatically high steep mountains you're about to encounter from the Holyford Valley to Milford Sound. This rock also forms the glittering walls of the Homer Tunnel ahead of you. It's only in the last 1 million years that the glaciers came and did their bit. Fiordland has experienced repeated ice ages during that time, and as the ice pushed its way down from the frozen mountaintops, it filled this valley to the brim, all the way back to Te Anau and Manapouri. Other glaciers ran down towards the coast, eroding the valleys well below present sea level. As the glaciers retreated and sea levels rose, the formation of the fjords was complete. In many cases, the water is actually deeper inside the mouth of the fjord than it is outside, due to the erosive power of all that ice and the huge volume of sediments it deposited just offshore. Two rock types of particular interest to you may be the limestone on the western shore of Lake Te Anau, which contains a beautiful system of caves, some of which are accessible by daily tours from Te Anau. These caves formed over the last 15,000 years as the glaciers retreated and the work of flowing water took over, first dissolving out the limestone to form caverns and tunnels, and later forming stalactites. The other rock type of note is the famous greenstone. It's one of the main reasons Maori made the hazardous trek through these mountains. The translucent, jade-green rock they called Pōnamu can be found around the Fiordland coast, one of only a few known Pōnamu areas in the country. Pōnamu is an important and highly prized commodity in Maori culture and was used to make jewellery, weapons, tools and talismans. Many of the traditional designs have survived, and nowadays you can see beautiful greenstone carvings in most New Zealand craft and tourist shops. The shaping of Fiordland is by no means over. The mountains continue to rise, and the elements continue to reshape their contours. The geological future of the area is hard to predict. There may be more glacial periods to come, and maybe, one day, this could all be eroded to sea level. That's not likely to happen for many millions of years, but let's make the most of it now. We'll be coming up to Lake Gunn in a while, where there's an opportunity to take a nature walk. It takes about 45 minutes, and it's highly recommended. It'll give you a chance to really immerse yourself in some of these natural wonders you've been hearing about. In fact, you could be hearing something like this: the calls of our New Zealand birds. We're now climbing up towards the Divide, which is the pass that separates the Eglinton from the Holyford Valley. A series of lakes fill the valley here, each one higher than the last. We'll soon start to follow Lake Gun on our left, and when we reach the end of this lake, we cross the connecting river and we'll then have Lake Fergus on our right, followed by the smaller Lake Lochie. That's the Livingston mountain range up to your right, which culminates in the lone peak of Key Summit. You'll see it rising from the end of the ranges as we cross the divide. If you're keen for some mountain scenery, you can climb Key Summit in about 3 hours' return, and with good visibility, you'll be able to see across the mountaintops for miles. The Divide Car Park is the starting point not just for the Key Summit Walk, but also for three of Fiordland's long-distance walks, the Rootburn, Greenstone, and Capel's Walks. All begin here, and branch off to your right along the valleys of the same name. If you fancy a quick taster, Key Summit Track follows the Rootburn track for about an hour before peeling off for the 30-minute climb. Make sure you dress warmly, though. It can get a bit nippy up there. In the last ice age, Key Summit was buried under 500 meters of ice. But now, it towers 500 meters above the valley floor. If you remember, the car park is also the starting point for three long-distance walks, which are just as rewarding as the Milford Track. In fact, there are plenty of dedicated trampers who'd swear that the tracks up here are even better than the Milford. The Greenstone runs north, the Rootburn heads south, and the Capel's Track leaves the Greenstone and goes around the other side of the mountains before rejoining it at the far end on Lake Wakatipu, which is the longest lake in New Zealand, and the one on which Queenstown sits. The Rootburn Track opened in the 1880s. It takes 3 days and offers magical panoramas across glaciers, frosted peaks, and the tranquil mountain lakes. On day two, you also get a good view of Fiordland's highest mountain, the mighty Mount Tutoko, as well as incredible views across the mountains and even out to the sea. The track heads north and then east right up to the Serpentine Mountains, eventually descending to meet the tarmac, where you can hop on a bus into Glenorchy or all the way to Queenstown. Down the Holyford Road is the start of the Holyford Track, which at 56 kilometres is even longer than the Milford Track. It takes 4 or 5 days to do and is open all year round because it doesn't pass through any snowfields. Once you get to the other end, you can either fly out, retrace your steps, or book a seat on a jet boat and zoom back along the river. This is perhaps the most diverse of all Fiordland's great walks, with scenery ranging from lofty glaciers through lowland swamp, barren rock fields, forested lakes, and coastal sand dunes. It runs all the way along the Holyford Valley to the surf-pounded sands of Martin's Bay. Martin's Bay is a little way north of Milford Sound and had a brief flirtation with fame in the 19th century when big plans were made for it. Martin's Bay was well known to the Māori, who had a settlement there from about 1650 to the 1800s, so they could take advantage of the seafood, forest and lake foods, the greenstone, and the big trees that were ideal for canoe building. David McCallar and George Gunn were the first Europeans to see the Holyford Valley and Martin's Bay from the top of Key Summit in 1861. But the first recorded visit to the golden beaches of Martin's Bay was paid by a man called Patrick Capels 2 years later. He was in search of gold, and the stories that Capels told when he got back were enough to inspire local whaler Captain Alabaster and two of his mates to check out the gold mining prospects soon after. When they got to Martin's Bay, they met an old Māori chief called Tutoko living there, and didn't find him to be unfriendly at all. In fact, Tutoko let them borrow his precious canoe as they paddled up the river to explore Lake Makero. They thanked him by bestowing his name on the formidable Mount Tutoko, nearly 3 kilometres high. A few weeks after the trio returned to civilization, geologist Dr. James Hector headed to Martin's Bay too. Hector went on to break through to Queenstown from the coast and proposed building a road from Queenstown to the bay and developing a port there. This was a very attractive idea because a coast link to Queenstown and shorter sailing route to Australia would improve the area's gold trade enormously. Fiordland was in the grip of its gold rush, but getting the goodies out of the remote area was problematic, so an efficient trade route would have been quite handy. But so far, the walking track remains the only land route to Martin's Bay. But the idea of building a port did get off the ground, and the handfuls of gold that people kept returning from the bay with ignited a small gold rush to the area. The superintendent of Otago, James McAndrew, was an ardent advocate of developing the area, and the proposed settlement was named Jamestown in his honour. Work commenced on the banks of Lake Makero, a little way up the river from Martin's Bay. The pioneering settlers arrived in 1870, and Jamestown grew into a settlement of about 8 houses, plus a store and a pub. But it was an uphill struggle for the settlers. Within only a few years, most of the citizens of Jamestown had given up and moved on. Nowadays, the town has been almost entirely reclaimed by the forest, only a few apple trees and stone chimneys remaining. A couple of families stayed on and stuck it out, though, including the Mackenzies, who continued to keep cattle there until 1926. They sold up to legendary local Davy Gunn, no relation to George, who drove his cattle over 250 kilometres of rugged terrain every year for 29 years. Always ready to welcome tourists, Davy was sadly the last resident of Jamestown. After he drowned in the river in 1955, his homestead lay empty and abandoned. His son Murray is still about, though, and now runs Gunn's Camp and Museum on the Hollyford Road.